Welcome to Future of Freedom. I'm your host, Scott Bertram. Future of Freedom is a production of America's Talking Network. You can check out all of our great podcasts at americastalking.com. Joining me today is Catherine Mengyu Ward. She is editor-in-chief of Reason. Starting at Reason as an intern back in 2000, also has worked at the Weekly Standard and the New York Times. You might have seen her writing elsewhere, too, in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, a frequent commentator on radio and TV networks like NPR, CNBC, C-SPAN, Fox Business, and more. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us here on Future of Freedom.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So Reason magazine, arguing for liberty and individual choice, the tagline, free minds and free markets. What do you see as the purpose of Reason? Why does it exist? What is your job as editor-in-chief?
So Reason has been around a long time. We are more than 50 years old, and we've been fighting the same fights the whole time. And that's sort of the good news and bad news of what we do. We are extremely consistent. We want to make the world more free, more fair, more fun. We see ourselves as advocating for especially the free movement of people, goods, and ideas across borders. And that's been our mission all along. The people we're hoping to reach are individuals, just regular schmoes who might pick up a magazine or see one of our videos or listen to a podcast. But we also hope to reach stakeholders in the legislative and, you know, bureaucratic processes, especially here in Washington. The magazine typically covers national politics, but we also have a think tank, and they really focus on the state level. And so they're looking to make change in legislatures as well. So we are for the people, but also we hope that occasionally the people who hold power will listen to what we have to say as well.
I think, of course, we have to discuss libertarianism. We will throughout our conversation today. There's the old saying that that a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged. A liberal is a conservative who's been arrested. Who are libertarians? How do they fit into that matrix?
Well, I'd hope that we are going to be neither mugged nor arrested on this podcast or at any other time. But libertarians, I think, you know, we occupy a very unique place in American politics. Everyone hates us, but also everyone has something to love about what we're bringing to the table. I often think of libertarians as kind of a gateway drug to bipartisan friendship. So if you are, you know, trapped in your bubble, you only know other liberals, say. Maybe you are on, I don't know, a college campus. Just seek out a libertarian, and at the very least, you can agree on, for instance, the need for criminal justice reform, maybe decriminalization or deregulation of drugs. And, you know, after that, we can start talking a little bit more, maybe fighting a little bit about taxes or economic freedom. But, of course, you can do the same thing from the right as well. So, you know, for me, libertarianism is absolutely kind of a redheaded stepchild of American politics. But I think we have a place, and that place is to help build ad hoc coalitions to get stuff done, often stuff that's very common sense. But that people are sort of entrenched in their two partisan categories and can't see their way to making a deal.
Now, why do you say that people hate libertarians? I know a lot of libertarians. I know Matt Welch and Nick Gillespie, guests and podcasts. We're getting to know you, friendly people. Why do you say people hate libertarians?
You know, that's a good question. I think we're lovable. But, you know, I think that right now the brand of capitalism is struggling. And I think people strongly associate libertarians, as they should, with free market capitalism. There's a real hostility, especially among younger people, to the ideas of free markets and free enterprise. And there's a real, unfortunately, there's a real kind of convergence on the left and the right against kind of the idea of neoliberalism or globalization, free trade at the largest level around the world. Used to be that Republicans would at least pay lip service, even though sometimes they did not fully honor that principle. Likewise, there was a kind of mainstream Democratic consensus in favor of global trade. That's eroding. And so that's actually one beat that we are on right now at Reason, is trying to refresh, reinvigorate the case for having commercial ties with people around the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really important. I think that it's a little bit unfashionable right now. And so that's at least one reason people don't like libertarians.
We should draw a distinction between the small L libertarian movement, the big L libertarian party. There is no official connection between Reason and the big L libertarian party. There, of course, is one between Reason and the small L libertarian movement. How would you describe generally the relationship between the small L movement and the big L party?
Fraught is how I would describe it. So the Libertarian Party is actually a more recent creation than Reason Magazine, and certainly more recent than the libertarian movement more broadly, especially depending on how you count. There are certainly people who trace libertarianism, which is typically an American 20th century term. They connect it to classical liberalism. Mm-hmm. And so they go all the way back to, you know, our pals in the Scottish Enlightenment, same deal. And I think that's a true lineage. I think that those connections make sense. The Libertarian Party is a very special creature that is, you know, I think has consistently gotten quite a raw deal. American politics have all the hallmarks of a duopoly. They really lock out third-party contenders. It's not just the LP that suffers from this. Green Party and others struggle as well. I am not a member of the Libertarian Party. I typically don't follow what they are up to that closely. For me, what matters is libertarian ideas and the mm-hmm. libertarian movement. And I think that many of the big successes of libertarianism have been when one of our ideas gets absorbed into the mainstream. And sometimes that can feel not like a win that you sort of chalk up on the scoreboard, mm-hmm. but it's a win nonetheless. And I think that ranges from you know, everything from just basic principles of free speech to something very specific, like, for instance, the decriminalization of marijuana.
I want to come back to that question here in a little bit. We're talking with Catherine Mengue Ward, editor-in-chief of Reason, here on the Future of Freedom podcast. Reason magazine and the website exists in a crowded space of political commentary. What do you think that Reason does better than anybody else?
I love the opportunity to brag. So here's what I think Reason does better than anybody else. A couple of things go into it. The first is, you know, we put our biases on our sleeve. I think basically every publication that you read, every, you know, TV news program that you watch, they have biases. Of course they do. They're human. And, you know, the attempts to kind of conceal or deny those biases lead to all kinds of distortions and perversions in the way that the news is covered. We just say, hey, it's right there on the cover. We believe in free minds and free markets. This is what we do. We are bringing you analysis and news and entertainment all from that perspective. But you're not going to win friends and influence people unless you're bringing something else to the table. And in our case, that's really, really solid journalism. So we are doing investigative reporting. You know, we are elbow deep in FOIA requests for all kinds of topics. We are doing, shoe leather. We just go out and see what there is to see and write about it. And of course, our video team in particular does these sort of mini documentaries, essentially, where they are bringing just a ton of fresh information and other voices to the conversation. So we are not just rehearsing the same old dogma every day. We're trying to bring classically journalistic, kind of fair, accurately reported information into the conversation. But we want you to know that we're doing that from a worldview that we think is good and important. And so that's, you know, to me, that is the selling proposition of Reason's journalism. Again, we also have our think tank, which does a very, very different project. And I think they do it really well as well.
Polling tells us, and just speaking to the American voter would tell us, that Americans are pretty desperate for a third party, for an alternative. More continue to identify as independents. We've seen various movements have some moments. The Reform Party through Ross Perot and later Pat Buchanan had a little moment. The Green Party, especially regionally, has these moments from time to time. Why has the Libertarian Party / Libertarian movement perhaps not had a moment like that over the past 50 years?
So actually, there was a... I don't know if you would call it a real libertarian moment. There was a moment that people were calling the libertarian moment. And that ranged somewhere between, let's say, 2008 and maybe 2015. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that you will see from time to time, especially on Twitter among some of the kind of new traditionalist conservatives, the more reactionary conservatives, I might say, you see these tweets that say stuff like, libertarians have been in charge long enough. And it's like, did I miss it? Shoot. Ugh, here I was in charge all this time.
You would have liked to have celebrated like that.
But I do think there was a moment when, some sort of the consensus around the ideas of openness of trade, of free speech, of some other things, at least in theory, were stronger. And we see these micro moments as well. So, we were deep in COVID summer. Obviously, we saw, protests sometimes crossing over into riots or violence in the streets about police misconduct. And Reason was like, oh, we've been on this topic for a long time. Literally, our first issue has an essay about police violence. Maybe this is the moment. Maybe we're going to do reform. Unfortunately, that movement quickly collapsed into something, I think, less productive and more polarizing. But we do look for these kind of micro moments. Maybe it's never going to be the libertarian moment. But I genuinely believe, and I think a lot of folks on the kind of moderate American right believe this, that America itself is a libertarian experiment. Mm. I think the founders had so much of what I would see as kind of the deep principles of libertarianism in their DNA. And they really brought that to everything that happens in this country. Would I love for us to be much more radically free in terms of economic liberty? Yes. Would I love our tax burden to be spectacularly lower? Yes. Would I love our budgetary process to connect to reality in any way? Yes. Would I love to see us dramatically reduce the number of people we incarcerate? As you know, we lead the world in that. Of course, there's many, many things that need to be done from the perspective of a libertarian, but I still think the U.S. has some core principles, especially due process and civil liberties, that are unmistakably libertarian.
Are there examples of the libertarian philosophy as a governing philosophy winning and succeeding? And not on particular issues. I'll ask about that in a moment, but sort of a big picture libertarian government philosophy. Has that been tried and succeeded in some places?
Yeah, I think it just depends on how thematic you're getting here. But I would say that, there are certainly times and places where citizens have looked around and said, at the most basic level, government is doing too much. And I think, the idea of a small, competent government is at the heart of many, many people's libertarianism. We actually did a piece years ago in Reason magazine that I think about all the time, which was just three examples of times when government actually shrank, right? So not the rate of growth slowed, not some program was cut, but what does it look like to genuinely shrink the size and scope of your government? And one thing that's interesting is that two of those examples were done by essentially liberal governments. So it sort of gets back to what I was saying earlier that, it may not be that the Libertarian Party is the way forward here, but there are ideas in the air. And sometimes you do see this, for instance, in the 90s in New Zealand, for instance, in the U.S. after World War II.
So on specific issues, on particular issues, where do you guys, I mean that in a friendly way, where do libertarians take a W? Where do you say we've been successful at Reason, we've been successful elsewhere in sort of dragging the right, dragging the left closer to our philosophy and actually seeing some of these laws implemented or laws changed in a more libertarian direction?
So I would say the two clearest wins that are sort of in my memory or my lifetime are the legalization of gay marriage and the movement toward the legalization and decriminalization of marijuana. I think those are two things that appeared in the pages of Reason in the 60s and 70s and were considered absolutely insane. Like, I'm not sure we can capture the extent to which writing an editorial about either of these topics in 1975 was just perfectly laughable. Mm-hmm. And yet, here we are. So I think those are kind of two very concrete places I think, you know, more broadly, there are a couple other things that you can point to. And one of them is happening right now, actually, which is I think we are finally seeing a movement against NIMBYism. This is mm-hmm. kind of a small mm-hmm. topic, but it's something that really matters to a lot of people. The not in my backyard movement, the idea that everyone should have a veto on what everyone else does on their property. And I think that that has finally hit the point where people are kind of fed up. Generally, I don't think the correct strategy is to wait till things get bad enough and everyone's furious and then everyone will wake up the next day a libertarian. That's not how it happens. But in this case, we are seeing that a little bit. And I think that that's really good and powerful. Of course, one of the libertarian movement's earliest wins, I would say, was the ending of the draft. Mm-hmm. That's strongly associated with one of our kind of great founding figures, Milton Friedman, and was such a huge development for just personal liberty. Again, it's long enough ago that I think a lot of people who might be thinking about what has the movement done or what have we accomplished, you know, this is taken for granted, but we shouldn't take it for granted. Many, many times in many places, that was something that you could be expected to suffer, to be called up to serve without your permission.
Catherine, Charles C.W. Cook at National Review, who's a friend, has written a book called The Conservatarian Manifesto. The conservatarian, does it exist in your mind? Is it an animal that exists? Do you have a clear idea of what a hybrid like that looks like?
Sure. I would be delighted by an American politics populated entirely by clones of Cook. He is great. I think his analysis is really sound on so many issues. He and I don't agree on everything, but I think that in many ways that has historically been the way forward for libertarians into mainstream politics. I came up in the fusionist tradition, right? So this is the ideas put forward by Frank Meyer, that you cannot have a proper understanding of liberty without responsibility and vice versa, and that those two ideas, which we associate broadly with libertarianism and conservatism, depend on each other. I think sometimes people say, oh, fusionism is just a coalition and it was a shaky one, and when communism fell, so too the coalition started to crumble. My colleague Stephanie Slade has written, I think very compellingly, that there's much more to it than that, and that there really is a kind of a deep connection between American libertarianism and American conservatism, correctly understood. That said, unfortunately, I think the American conservative movement at this time is moving away from that insight. They are moving away from the fusionist understanding and towards something that is much more authoritarian, that says, you know what, maybe the other side started it, but we now have no choice but to use kind of much more authoritarian and heavy-handed tactics to achieve the virtuous society. I think that's very wrongheaded. You know, Cook is really on the right. He rightly understands this and rightly understands the relationship between a free society and a good society.
I have to ask about your pinned tweet, which has been up there for a couple of years now, which says, why is it that when you say, I believe we must legalize / decriminalize all drugs, every single person follows up by asking, even heroin? What do you think all means? So the libertarian curious, who really like the idea of free minds and free markets, but is perhaps scared a bit when you say, let's legalize heroin. Is there such a thing as incremental libertarianism that might attract those sort of people more broadly to the movement?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, my pinned tweet is much more about warning people about the tone of my Twitter feed than anything else.
Okay.
I certainly, but I do think that, of course, if you read Reason, if you listen to our podcasts, if you follow us on social media, if you watch our videos, you will see all kinds of proposals that we are entertaining very seriously that are almost comically incremental, right? Hey, we just were hoping that maybe we could slightly reduce the bureaucratic constraints on starting a small business. Hey, we were just curious if maybe we could like generate a waiver for imports of baby formula at a time when we are in total crisis with a shortage. Like we often are arguing the tiniest little mm-hmm. baby steps toward freedom. But the reason that's my pinned tweet in part is because I think that if you properly understand political liberty, a huge, huge, huge component of that is you have to be willing to let people do things you think are bad. And I think that that's something that both the left and the right and American politics really struggle to hold on to, even though both say in their own way that they are committed to liberty. The minute you say, okay, well, I want to use my liberty to do something you don't like, even if it's not hurting other people, they say, oh, no, 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 not that. You can't have that liberty. And I think it's important to remember that real toleration, real freedom means people are going to do stuff you think is abhorrent. And that's not what the conversation should be about. The conversation should be about how do we put appropriate boundaries on people not harming each other. You know, don't hurt other people and don't take their stuff is a way that sometimes we say this. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we can have a legitimate debate about how we get from here to there. But we have to remember that the ideal world, the ideal libertarian world, does not contain a bunch of people just like me doing just what I would do. Hmm. That's not what freedom looks like, and it never will.
Catherine Mengu Ward is with us, editor-in-chief of Reason. A few more minutes with her here on the Future of Freedom podcast. You mentioned earlier the fight for criminal justice reform and the incarceration rate here in the U.S. Has the effort behind criminal justice reform taken a hit due to the crime numbers we've seen in the past year or two? Has that been a detriment to the movement? And is there a way to get past that in your mind?
Absolutely. This has been something that criminal justice reformers have been talking about for a long time. You know, we have been in a genuinely amazing world historical period of decline in crime. Mm-hmm. If you look at the numbers from times that we typically think of, I think through kind of rose-tinted or like a golden backward-looking lens, if you look at the crime statistics in the late 80s, it was much more dangerous. It was America was a much more dangerous place, and the world was a much more dangerous place. And we have been in this broadly in this period of declining crime rates for so long that almost everyone currently working in the criminal justice reform movement or covering that beat for reasons, say, has always been able to do it from the point of crime rates are going down. Why are incarceration rates going up? Crime mm-hmm. rates are going down. Why are police tactics increasingly, you know, oriented towards SWAT and quasi-military tactics? Crime rates are going down. Why are we spending so much more on policing? Crime rates are going down. Why are we offering police officers more immunity from prosecution if they do something wrong? And the first part of that sentence is going away. And we knew that that would happen. But it's going to make those arguments harder to make to, you know, a legislature, say, that might be inclined to reform. It doesn't make the arguments less compelling, to my mind. There are still incredibly powerful reasons not to lock up people who do victimless crimes. There are still incredibly powerful reasons to hold police officers accountable. There are still incredibly powerful reasons to exercise fiscal restraint at the local and state level, especially for the funding of funding of law enforcement. But it is historically true that when people perceive that crime is going up, and right now the increase in crime is actually still quite minor, mm-hmm. but it's psychologically looming quite large. And that is something that reformers are going to have to reckon with.
Catherine, you wrote a piece in Reason in 2021 that made the argument about politicians and politics today sacrificing nearly everything to accomplish short-term gains at the expense of long-term goals. How do we incentivize politicians and leaders to plan for the future and not plan for the next election cycle?
You know, I really think that is the biggest question. And I don't have a foolproof answer to it. But one answer is just a process answer. It's not glamorous at all. But right now, for instance, every time we have a transfer of power, a new president comes in, sits down at the, you know, in the Oval Office and starts reversing a bunch of executive orders. Most of them are stuff that shouldn't have been done by executive order in the mm-hmm. first place. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think the simplest answer here is that Congress should do its darn job. And Congress has shown that it is quite unwilling to do that in recent years or unable. I'm not sure which. Mm-hmm. You know, lawmaking can and should originate with that body. And instead, we are letting presidents, you know, with a signature, set a huge amount of our immigration policy. They are waging war, essentially, with Congress's permission, but not in a way that I think is structurally sound. And there's just many, many things like that where I think we would be much better served to push some of that back into Congress's hands and, as much as possible, into state legislature and state governor's hands. You know, I don't love the decisions that every state governor has made of late, but I think that the closer we get to individuals, the closer we get to individual voters, the slightly increased chance of accountability, at least at the ballot box. And that seems to me to be the only way forward.
Final question for Catherine Mangue Ward here on the Future of Freedom podcast. We talked about the war on drugs a bit. We talked about criminal justice reform. Where do you see the next battlefields in the fight in the next decade or so when we discuss free minds and free markets? What are the next topics that are on the agenda?
You know, it's tough because the agenda feels really full right now. you know, I think the battle for free speech is one that is really evolving right now. Many of the traditional combatants have really abandoned the field. The ACLU, for instance, has changed its mission in ways that I think are really harmful. I'm delighted to see FIRE stepping up. They had previously focused on campus issues, and they're going to be going more broadly. I think the legal right to say anything you want, more or less, is really important. And the cultural norm of being tolerant of different views, again, if you give people freedom, they're going to do stuff with it you don't love, but that's part of the deal. So I think that's probably number one. And then number two is, more in the free markets category. You know, we have been predicting for a long, long time at Reason that the bill is going to come due on our overspending and our over-aggressive manipulation of the money supply and the economy. And it seems like it might be coming due. I don't know. I hope I'm wrong. But when that happens, there are going to have to be some really tough choices. And I think that organizations like Reason have already done all the homework on how to get from where we are to a more fiscally responsible world, a more fiscally responsible country. So we're happy to help out when people realize it's time. But it's going to take a lot of work to untangle the damage we've done. And some of it, you know, we'll have to pay back what we owe on the sort of most basic level. And we're going to have to do that with money that we don't have. And I think that is going to be something that echoes through almost every single part of our politics. Mm-hmm. And I hope that we can manage to kind of rally and think about this in a principled way and do it systematically rather than just panicking.
Catherine Mangue Ward is editor-in-chief of Reason. You can find more of her work and the work of all of Reason's fine writers at reason.com. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us here on the Future of Freedom podcast.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Scott Bertram. For more episodes of the Future of Freedom podcast and other fine productions of the America's Talking Network, check out americastalking.com or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Future of Freedom, presented by America's Talking Network.